From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lori Walsh, host of In the Moment. As we roll into July, new legislation takes effect in South Dakota, including bills that pave the way for lawmakers to study in depth some of the more complex issues in the state. This week, we get a glimpse into lawmakers' goals and strategies as they study access to mental health services in South Dakota and special education funding for school kids with disabilities. We'll talk with lawmakers seeking to understand how industrial hemp might intersect with South Dakota ag policy, plus a political challenge for U.S. Senator Mike Rounds from within his own party. Let's get started. Where do elderly South Dakotans go for inpatient mental health services, and how long do they stay for those services? Representative Jean Hunhoff is chairing a committee studying the issue. Representative Hunhoff, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, good morning, Lori, and thanks for inviting me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Before we get into the details of what's ahead for this study, I'm wondering if you would let us know your interest over the years. This is a topic that you're not just new to the conversation.
No, I'm not. I am a registered nurse. I've been in practice for the past 30 years and have been involved in all facets, and especially the majority of my career was in home care and hospice, so certainly was dealing with the end spectrum and elderly population. Also, being from Yankton, I live physically across the street from the Human Service Center and have been actively involved there. And so with my passion and my desire always to look at what is the highest quality of care we can deliver to our South Dakota residents, especially with mental health. You know, people are still on the time frame that mental health illness is something that you can just cure overnight. Just like if I have a ruptured appendix, or I shouldn't say ruptured, but I have a hot appy and they take it out, I'm fine in 6 weeks. I'm going to go on. But mental illness is long term. And so we need to recognize that, and we need to start looking at that. And with everything else that's going on with healthcare in our state, this certainly is rising to the top. And last summer, when we had the major study on mental health access, a lot of the topics that are being studied this summer were assessed, ferreted out, and we came up with these priority areas to address.
From a housekeeping standpoint, tell us a little bit about the upcoming meeting, some of the areas that you intend to cover so people know what's on the agenda.
Thank you. We did set our first meeting for July 17th, and that will be in Pier. And what we want at this first meeting is really an overview of the long-term care unit or geriatric unit at the Human Service Center. And that will be provided by Amy Iverson-Polarize from the Department of Social Services. And a lot of the members of the committee, legislative-wise, are probably new to this arena unless they've had some personal experience of family members at HSC. So really getting a historical perspective, how the unit was started, what is the process for someone coming from the community into the HSC long-term care? What are the sources of referrals? What is the diagnosis of those populations, and how has that changed over the course of time? Length of stay, why do residents not go back to the community? How many of the residents do not have family or are wards of the state? And then what is the primary payer source, or how are we finding resources to support these activities? Then in the afternoon, we're going to look at some case studies. Certainly over the course of the year, we have heard a lot of discussion coming from West River, especially the Rapid City area, about the lack of access. And certainly when they have someone, they have to come way across the state to have that individual placed in the facility and then maybe not return. So we want to hear about some case studies or some examples of that are occurring. And then the final piece is we want to look at models in other states. You know, this has been our model in South Dakota, but unless we reach out and explore what other states are doing, are they continuing to have long-term care facilities in their mental health facilities, or something else happening? You always get a better perspective of what other models are out there and what might be achievable. So that will be what we'll cover at our first meeting, and also will provide opportunity for public input. Later on, late summer, early fall, we will have another meeting. We will formulate that agenda after we complete this first meeting to see if there are other areas we need to explore. And then we will have a final meeting in November where we'll sort of do an overall closure and see if we can concur on some recommendations or some potential legislation that would be introduced in the 2020 session.
There's a public input time frame. What kind of public testimony is useful in these sort of meetings when there's so much information coming at lawmakers? If people are thinking about participating and they have a story to tell, what sort of stories do you want to hear? What works and what's effective?
I think what works is if there's something that is dealing with long-term care and placement at the Human Service Center, it could be providers from long-term care that have taken someone to HSC and then they've said, I can't take that individual back. It might be coming to explain why they can't take those kind of individuals back to their facilities or back to their home communities. It could be families that are sharing stories that they only had this as an alternative was to have their family member admitted to the geriatric unit at HSC, and maybe they live at the other end of the state, so their ability to see and support that person is not there. And the other aspect, there could be some individuals themselves that have been impacted. So there's no closure, but my intent is to keep it focused on the long-term care facility at the Human Service Center, as that's where our focus is at.
Tell us a little bit about how that long-term care center operates that you already know, especially as it compares to, people who are spending time at an Avera facility, for example, or at another community facility. How are they different and how do their services overlap?
With that question, I'm not going to be specific to the private facilities that are in existence. They did come and provide testimony, but I'm more familiar with HSC. So really, that's the model that I'm looking at and that I'll describe to you. Currently we have 69 licensed beds that are certified by CMS for both Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement. And I would just use fiscal year 18. We had admissions or transfers from the acute care program of 30 individuals. The interesting piece is the length of stay for discharge patients. In fiscal year 18, it was 752.6 days. So that is years that people are staying there. So that suggests that when someone enters there, their likelihood of leaving and moving to another setting is very low probability. And I think that's what you might find in the private behavioral health, in the essence that they have short-term stays and then they're back into communities, into mental health centers, long-term care, whatever resources are out there. And I think the other interesting piece is when you're looking at the private sectors, those are generally voluntary committals. That means I'm seeking help, and so I'm going to that facility. Where at HSC in fiscal year 18, 92% of those individuals that entered that facility were involuntary committals. So that means that they were admitted. And the reason they were admitted, either there was some mental illness commitment or there was some chemical dependency or it was court ordered or it was just for the safety of that individual that they couldn't take care of themselves in another setting or whatever. And I think that's really where the changes or what we're trying to find out is, why is it that we have that length of stay and what's prohibiting these people returning to their home communities or at least someplace closer where there are behavioral health services? I think the other thing is when you look at diagnoses of what these individuals have, again, in fiscal year 18, 62% of those that were admitted to geriatrics have a diagnosis of dementia, Alzheimer's, or other neurocognitive disorder. And if you look at those are not necessarily mental illness. And that's the center, is a mental illness center to deal with that. So that raises the question, and in its statute, it talks about organic brain syndrome as one of the reasons. And I think that's something else we want to look at. People that suffer dementia or Alzheimer's, they have some cognitive weakening that's going on, and that could be due to just a deterioration of a brain matter or whatever. And so a reaction or what happens sometimes is that people become maybe verbally abusive or behaviorally abusive, and they're out in the community, either at home or in a facility, and they can't manage them. And so then those individuals are brought to HSC. And so do they really have a mentally ill diagnosis? And what we would be looking at in fiscal year 18, serious mental illness, there were 9 patients out of that population of 69. So again, we need to assess, are there other ways that we can provide excellent treatment to these individuals in a different type of setting, or is this our only alternative?
How does this all intersect with the broader conversation that we're having about nursing homes in general and some of the challenges in rural communities, particularly about funding nursing homes that are closing? Some of them may have memory care units, for example.
You know, in this past session, again, we certainly, that was our priority in funding, and the long-term care facilities did get a 10% increase. You know, funding will be an issue, and that will be what will come to the table. That will be part of the discussion, because one of the things is if you're keeping these individuals in a long-term care facility, in a nursing home, it does require probably more staffing, and it also requires that your staff have training in modalities or treatments that deal with behavioral health, which typically may not be the case. You know, the flavor of the long-term care facilities is changing. I don't know about you, but when my grandmother was in, she was a walker and a talker. That meant she had a walker, she got herself around doing things. The population now that is in long-term care is very much dependent upon almost total personal care, helping with their hygiene, helping with their dressing, with their meals, assisting them with activities of daily living. So that population has changed. And if it requires more staffing and more intense, then as providers out there, they don't have the workforce. So then they have to look at what can we provide for quality of care? What kind of patients can we admit? Because if you now have a compromised patient that has a chronic disease and an exacerbation, and you put on top of that some kind of cognitive dysfunctioning, being Alzheimer's or granic brain, again, then I'm going to need more staff. We've got a workforce shortage. So I think that we're trying to see, is there an opportunity that if we're going to do anything different, and we would try to take some of those individuals out of the nursing home at HSC and relocate them back to their communities, what kind of resources would those communities have to have those facilities? And of course, one of the ideas will be, well, we're going to have more dollars for Medicaid to support that. But you might also have to look at some other infrastructure or some delivery models. If you notice on our committee, we do have representation from long-term care, because I think that's important in any discussion about these individuals and doing something different. You've got to bring in long-term care. But how can we partner together to design a model that will facilitate? At the same time, in the communities, you have the behavioral health centers. Again, they are partners in this because they provide some of the resources to long-term care. Someone comes in and does the mental health with some of the residents. So it's not an easy answer. It's looking at a different model and how we can get it to work effectively.
Do you think, or is this not something that even comes into your mind, but is there an ideal for you, especially when what I'm thinking about is these people from West River who have said so vocally, and many people from rural communities too, that the location of HSC is, you know, separates families. It makes it incredibly difficult. In your mind, is there sort of an ideal way to meet the needs of elderly people who need these kinds of services in South Dakota? If you could, you know, wave a magic wand, what would it look like?
You know, I don't want to be biased in that. I want to keep a very open mind. I have some ideas, but again, I need to hear all the scenarios that are out there, and I want my committee members to also hear that. And again, I'm not sure of their working relationship with HSC and what they know about. So, you know, I think we have to look at a model that you just addressed. How can we increase that access so they wouldn't have to leave their community? How do we have the right resources, that being the professional staff, to deal with behavioral health? If you're going to put them in a long-term care facility, what are the educational resources that need to be for staff in how to deal with behavioral health issues? And then again, do you have the mental health practitioners in that community that can provide the support basis? So I think I'm more looking at what are the components that would be a nice continuum, and then how do you work to make that happen?
Senate Bill 3 authorized the Special Education Interim Study Committee. State Representative Nancy Rasmussen chairs the committee, which holds its first meeting on July 11th. Here's a preview. Representative Rasmussen, thanks for being here.
Yes, thank you for your invitation. I am so pleased to visit with you today.
What are some of the things that you'll be looking into with this more in-depth study? Where do you want to begin there?
Well, the first The first thing that we are asked to address is to examine the diagnostic tools and the assessments that are used to identify a student who needs special education or special education and related services. And I think that's important for everyone to understand that some students, there are six levels that students are put into categories depending on the severity of their issue or conditions. And some students need in or out of classroom supports in education, but there are other students who have more needs, and that might need a speech therapist, an occupational therapist. So those are the related services that would go along with the special education. So that's the first thing that we will be looking at on the 11th. And the next one is to examine the disability categories. And as I said, there are six of them. And there are some categories that are arising at a higher rate than others. Autism is one. And then to review the eligibility requirements. And last year, a lot of this was covered. Linda Turner did from the Department of Education did a wonderful job. And I would encourage anyone who's interested to go back to the 2018 committee and listen to those sessions. And the increase to teacher funding a couple of years ago gave increases to regular education, but did not give that same raise of funds in special education. So to me, it's a double need.
Some challenges.
We have categories that are rising in autism. When you have students that need extra occupational therapy or speech therapy, especially with the distance between schools, we have a lot of rural schools, and that is an issue. So then they're going to examine the common cost, or we are going to examine the common cost associated with the Extraordinary Cost Fund application. Schools need to apply for those funds, and some students need to be put or placed out of their district, and that raises the cost.
Right.
And then we're going to try and develop some recommendations to address the rising costs and the needs.
The challenges of such an important and complex education philosophy here in South Dakota continues to change and evolve. Representative Nancy Rasmussen, thank you so much for being here with us today. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
A group of South Dakota legislators will get together this summer to study the regulations and the costs of putting an industrial hemp program in place. State Representative Lee Qualm chairs the group. Representative Orrin Lesmeister is a committee member. We talked about what industrial hemp production might look like in South Dakota, and the lawmakers offered advice for farmers hoping to explore options for their acres. Representative Qualm, thanks for being with us.
You bet. Glad to be on.
Also, during this last legislative session, Orrin Lesmeister, a Democratic state representative from District 28A, led the charge on industrial hemp legislation, and he is joining us by phone as well. Representative Lesmeister, thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Lee Qualm, tell us where the summer study is at.
Well, the first meeting will be in Pierre on July 11th, starting at 9 o'clock. In room 414. There were several of us that had the opportunity to go down to Kentucky and visit with some people. Kentucky has been dealing with hemp since 2014 on an experimental basis, and they are going full guns forward this coming year. Their acreage on hemp has gone from 6,000 acres up to 57,000 acres. And visiting with them, we visited with law enforcement, we visited with Department of Ag, we visited with industry down there. And we got a lot of very, very good information. And some of these people will be testifying in the committee the first time we meet. And I certainly look forward to that. I certainly look forward to everybody hearing what we heard down there. It really enlightened us on and how we can move forward with this process.
Representative Les Meister, for people who are still trying to get their mind around what industrial hemp is and what it is not, explain that to us, please.
Industrial hemp, you know, it is part of the cannabis family, and that's where people get misinformed between it and marijuana. They think it's the same plant and has the same characteristics, which they do have a lot of the same characteristics. But when you look at the marijuana industry versus the hemp industry, they're really going two totally different directions. The common factor is CBD oil from both of them. One contains THC levels that are higher. Hemp-derived CBD oil is like in the Gincana plant we went through in Kentucky. They extracted at zero THC levels. So, and then with hemp and industrial hemp, it's also for fiber and clothing. You know, the whole market opens up hempcrete, hemp houses. I mean, it's just opened up a whole new world to do with the fiber side of things with it also. So really they're very similar plants. They're first cousins, if you will, but they're going two totally different directions at this time.
So, Oren, what do you think the possibilities are for the ag industry in South Dakota? Where do you see, I mean, are we, you know, from a climate perspective, we're different from Kentucky, aren't we? What do you think the potential is here?
Well, I think the potential is unlimited. I think the sky's the limit. You know, there is some things that we have to take in consideration as far as farmers and ranchers, industry professionals, is this is a brand new crop to us, even though it's the oldest crop in the world, per se, and it's grown here back in the until the, you know, through the 40s, really. But this is a brand new crop to us, and we're going to have to try it, you know, on a limited basis, see what's going to work for you, what type of a crop you're wanting to grow for, whether it's oil or whether it's fibers, you know, varieties change and everything. So it's got to be taken with some caution. I don't want anybody to go out there and just throw a ton of seed in the ground and think it's going to be great and rosy, because right now there's no chemicals that are labeled to go over top of this for weed control or anything else. So, you know, it's an experimental crop, even though it's opened up by the 2018 Farm Bill now nationwide. Everybody's got to err with some caution here and take a step back, plant some varieties that are going to work for you, find your markets. You know, that's another thing in South Dakota. We're going to have to get some industry started here and things. And we've got people that are interested in doing that. And I hope we can get them on board and hit the ground running here, because I think the sky's the limit, really, at the end of the day.
And I recall Governor Noem talking about drug dogs and really just challenges of officers even identifying the plant or being able to use the narcotics training that was in place. Did you find that was a struggle for folks in Kentucky?
Well, they talked about that a little bit, because a drug dog will hit on both hemp and marijuana. They both smell the same, but they didn't feel it was an issue. In order for anyone to grow hemp, they had to get a permit from the state government. And as long as they had that permit in their hand when they were transporting whatever, the state patrol was fine with it, and they were not going to have any issues with that. There's obviously hurdles out there that will have to be overcome as the years go by. But there are some portable testers out there where you can test for THC. I believe it's something that we certainly can overcome. I like the aspect of where if you have a permit and you're okayed by the Department of Ag, you're okay with a state patrol. Now, even with that said, we know there's always bad players out there. There's always that instance, and it's impossible to cover every instance, but we're going to do the best we can to come to the best solution that we can to make this work for everybody.
Tell us a little bit, you know, for the farmers who are sort of trying to plan for this and dealing with this new crop and what it might look like in their own operations. What's the time frame for folks? How do you? It's a little hard to predict right now when you might be making some of these decisions.
Well, I think, you know, if we can get things put together right with the summer study group, which I'm really confident we will, you know, we've got some hurdles, as Representative Qualm said, to jump, but I don't think they're too tall to jump. So I think we're going to get this covered. I think we're going to have a bill that everybody's going to be
in favor of come this fall. We get it pushed through during session, you know, and signed into law. I think it's one of the things this fall, people should really start looking at seed sources, at production, you know, where they're going to take it if they want to grow some. How many acres are they willing to take out of production to try this new venture, if they're willing to do that? Different varieties of seed and so on and so forth. I want people to plan as much as possible. There's a lot of information out there. North Dakota Department of Ag's website, for instance, has a lot of information on different stuff. Kentucky Department of Ag's website, Montana's, different places I've been to on these hemp tours over the last few years. They have a ton of information out there for people to access and start planning that. And I think it's one of the things I'm going to start planning for it. I'm positive we're going to get this done.
Summer legislative work is almost always bipartisan, at least in name. Political campaigns, not so much. This week, we saw the launch of a Republican challenge to Republican U.S. Senator Mike Rounds. Here's the recap.
Hi, Lori. How's it going?
Pretty well. Thank you very much. Good. All right. Let's talk about this announcement. Did it come as a surprise?
Well, you know, a lot of people I talked to had speculated that Borglum would announce a run for U.S. Senate, and that speculation really began when she started touring the state to talk to communities and put together a legislative package addressing rural education. And while she neither confirmed nor denied a run for U.S. Senate, that speculation only heightened when Borglum released that strongly worded press release in April that was titled South Dakota Republican Establishment Eating Its Young. And in that release, she stated that at a Lincoln Day dinner in Lawrence County up in the Northern Hills, that U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson, with henchmen like guile, demanded that Borglum confess whether she plans to primary Rounds in 2020. And now we know for sure that she is.
All right. How did she officially kick off her campaign then?
Well, it started off in the lobby of the Hotel Alex Johnson in downtown Rapid City. And in her campaign kickoff speech, she made it clear that she has, quote, common sense conservative values, which is a phrase I think you'll hear her use a lot in this campaign. She says time and pressure are eroding away conservative principles. And some of those principles that she supports is reducing the size of government, building a wall at the southern border, and reworking immigration policy as well, and also free market healthcare reform. And in defense of her conservatism, she points to her voting record on abortion. And she says that while Mike Rounds squeaked into office, or she says that Mike Rounds squeaked into office in 2014 with all the controversies surrounding him during his time as governor.
All right. So when people hear that sort of common sense conservative, talking point, how does that differentiate her from Senator Rounds? Most of her platform, ideas seem to be similar to his at this point.
Yeah. And I asked her that question following the announcement. And, she says it boils down to the size of government.
I do not believe in growing the size of government, and everything, every trend that I've seen in terms of his voting record and his time as a governor has simply increased our spending and increased the size of government. And we need to be done with that now. We need to start reining it back in.
All right. And how does she distinguish herself from Senator Rounds regarding immigration reform and backing President Trump's border wall?
You know, she did indicate a strong support for both, immigration reform and the border wall. And she says her immigration reform package will come out soon during the campaign. So we don't know quite yet. But she did point to a local reason why the country needs immigration reform.
When an MS-13 gang member can show up on the reservation and execute a 26-year-old man in the middle of a highway, we have a problem. Decriminalization is not common sense. It is a distraction away from the fact that the Democrats have yet to present a plan. And I have a plan that includes supporting President Trump to build the wall. We will rebuild our immigration policy. We do not want open borders, but we need a common sense conservative policy that builds consensus.
Now, she didn't say at the campaign announcement which reservation she was talking about. However, I did call the Oglala Sioux Tribe's public safety office, and the sheriff there says that he's not really sure what she's talking about in relation to the MS-13 gang member. Now, 3 years ago, there was a man by the name of Vinnie Brewer who was executed outside of the Sioux Ann Big Crow Center in a drug trafficking-related crime, but they aren't sure about any MS-13 connections there.
All right, so we have some hints from her words there, but what kind of campaign is Borglum looking to run?
Well, she says it's going to be a grassroots campaign with donations from the broader South Dakota citizenry. She says it would be funded by smaller amounts from the greater number of people who want to send her to Washington, and that's going to be her base.
My team and I do not have $1.5 million of lobbyist money in our bank accounts. We do not have the political mobsters backing us. And you know what? Good riddance to anyone who does, because you shouldn't need that to hold on to your elected office. But I'll tell you something. We have something far more powerful. We have common sense, conservative values.
And so I think early on, she's setting the tone that the, you know, the rhetoric, I think, has already escalated quite well in going after Senator Rounds. And it's important to note that according to the latest FEC filings, Rounds has just over $1 million in cash on hand and not $1.5 million.
What kind of crowd was there for the announcement, Lee? It sounds like she's speaking loudly as if there was a large crowd. Was there a large crowd?
I mean, I would say there was probably maybe 20 people there. It was in the lobby of the Hotel Alex Johnson, which does have some high ceilings.
Sure.
And it was a little loud in that auditorium, just from HVAC and stuff like that. But there was about a couple dozen, I would say.
All right. And what kind of response did you hear from them?
Well, so during her announcement, there were some prepared statements, and then they just opened it up for questions, and there were a few press questions, and then we saw State Representative Tim Goodwin was there and asked some questions, and then you also had the director of the Family Heritage Alliance to ask some questions, and then a couple others. There was some family there.
Sure.
Rob Schonsberg is Rounds' campaign spokesperson, and I reached out to him for a reaction. And he says there are 38 U.S. senators that support President Trump more than 90% of the time, and that Mike Rounds is one of them, and that Mike's overall conservative credentials are top two in the 2014 class, and that he's doing exactly what he said he would do in Washington. Now, Schonsberg goes on to say that typically a GOP primary challenge comes from the right, and they're kind of characterizing this challenge as a challenge from the left, and they call it bizarre that it would be the case here. So I think it's interesting also to note that both candidates trying to position themselves further to the right than the other.
Okay, so they're characterizing her as left of Senator Rounds.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. All right. It's also worth noting that Senator Rounds is with his wife, Jean, who we know is getting treatment. She needs to deal with a cancer diagnosis. So that's factoring into all of this as well. How mm-hmm. are Democrats responding?
While the Democratic candidate hasn't been announced yet for U.S. Senate to challenge for 2020, they've not surfaced yet. The party chair of the Democrats, Paul Hawks, says that, quote, Mike Rounds has spent his time in Washington following the other Senate Republicans and constantly putting the needs of, quote, millionaires and billionaires, large corporations, and special interests ahead of South Dakota families. And while Rounds and Borglum compete to cater to the far right of their base, Democrats, she says, will hold them accountable for their extreme position to do everything they can to put a strong infrastructure in place for their eventual nominee.
Hmm. All right, Lee Strubinger, great work. Thanks so much for the update. Here we go, huh?
Yeah, it's starting early.
We asked John Hunter, publisher of the Madison Daily Leader, for insight into the Schuyler Rounds challenge as part of our weekly Dakota Political Junkies conversation. John, thanks for being with us as we look forward to this long holiday weekend.
Yes, we sure do. Thanks for the invitation, Laurie.
It's always the people who show up for work on Wednesday before
and Friday.
and Friday, yes, exactly. All right, let's talk a little bit about a challenger for U.S. Senator Mike Rounds. A little bit of a surprise, although there have been rumors circulating about Schuyler Borglum, taking aim at Senator Rounds for quite some time. Thoughts on the announcement? What do you think?
Well, I think it's going to be an interesting primary, frankly, and they'll end up kind of defining within a fairly narrow band exactly who they are. They're both the conservative. Sometimes they seem to be trying to out-conservative the other, but I think they're probably pretty close in ideology. So they'll try to differentiate themselves from one another. So I'm looking forward to those discussions.
How does it change the scenario for Senator Rounds as he does his work in Washington? Now, does he have to pay attention to different things, or is it business as usual for him, really?
I think the latter. It's still pretty early in this process. There have been traditional times to announce, sometimes State Fair or Labor Day, or sometimes even the beginning of the year, depending on if it's a primary or general thing. So to have it in July 1st of the previous year, essentially a year until that primary. So I think Senator Rounds goes on as kind of business as usual. He'll vote, I think, the way he thinks is correct and not based on a primary election.
Right. And what does she have to do with the time that she has to make a name for herself, not only in this campaign, but potential campaigns in the future?
That's a great question. And again, from the earliness of this announcement, I think she needs to build name recognition. There's always a little bit of a burst, right, when you make the announcement, but now comes the time on the road and shaking hands at every opportunity. And this fall, not only state fair or local county fairs, but also, homecoming parades and school functions. And so it's a part-time campaign for her. She's employed as an engineer in Rapid City, and so you wouldn't have 168 hours in a week to campaign. So I think she'll be spending whatever hours she's not working, probably trying to get her name out there.
Now, I thought it was interesting how she came out of the gate with some tough words for Senator Rounds and some sharp criticism of him and of the Republican Party. What does it sort of say that someone like Senator Rounds, in fact, she was even going back to his time as governor of South Dakota and saying, these scandals are still hanging over his head and we need to do something about them. What do you think about some of the ways that she has come out in the campaign early on as indicating where she thinks he's vulnerable?
Well, as soon as I give my answer, I'd like to ask you the same question, because I think we could have a good dialogue in this thing too. But, Mike generally did not have to face some of I'm not sure scandal is the right word, but I guess so. The EB-5 thing and the gear up things that occurred when he was governor, at least part of that. So it didn't seem to be a huge part of his campaign last time. So there, she wants to kind of bring that back, and maybe other, Democrats would like to do that too, probably, for whoever they face. But if they would face Rounds again, if that stuff has been regurgitated and out in front again, they would probably prefer that. Yes, I think, and maybe this is an era of more harsh words than where people campaign. But it wasn't, I don't think, impolite words necessarily, so it wasn't.
No.
Bad.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it was particularly, awful rhetoric, just strong. You wouldn't run against him unless you had something to say about why
right.
You don't think he's doing his job, and it has to be more than I'd like to take his place. She's got some, people are still talking about some of those things during Governor Rounds' tenure as state governor and the legacy of those. They have not forgotten.
Well, it's part of who Mike is, right? I mean, that's, his history and both success and non-success as governor and senator are deserve to be brought up. That's what incumbents face, and I think challengers, kind of by their definition, are supposed to challenge those kinds of things.
Right. Do you think we'll see a Democrat challenger, or is this going to be a fight between these two in a primary alone?
Yeah, I don't know. There have been times when, really one notable one against Senator Thune, where they did not field a candidate. I would guess the Democrats would field a candidate, and I don't know who that is. There aren't as many candidates maybe available from the state legislature or others as that has grown more Republican.
Although Rounds is making the argument that she's the left, she's the left wing,
yeah,
wing candidate compared to him, so he's going to try to position her as not as conservative as
yeah, that's
he is.
Yeah. I find that interesting. Rob Schonsberg, kind of said that as well, and so I find that it's so. They're going to try to define themselves. Who's going to be more conservative, less conservative? I think that could be interesting.
I think the Democrats have an opportunity here in the sense that if he goes through a primary with a strong candidate, depending on how she runs her campaign, if he gets past her, he's vulnerable. And if she defeats him, boy, then you've got a race, right?
Well, and then what about an independent candidate, too?
Right.
Remember when Rounds ran 5 years ago, there were three, Rick Weiland and Larry Pressler and himself. So do you think there's a viable Democratic candidate, Lori?
I don't know if I would say viable. That's not for me to say, but I bet Mayor Mike Huther from Sioux Falls is having some thoughts right now. Because the last time we talked to him, he was not done serving the state of South Dakota.
And, it's time for another appearance on In the Moment.
It's time to bring back Mayor Mike. How about Billy Sutton? Why not?
Certainly a credible candidate and ran a great campaign for governor, and I'm sure that that he would be among the top considerations and a good one. And there are others, too. But Billy, I think, deserves that discussion.
All right. Let's make it interesting, huh? Even though when we start this early, that's one of the opportunities. And I'm personally, John, not one of those people who thinks that it shouldn't start too early because I like talking about politics, and I think it's interesting to always be asking. I mean, some of the rhetoric I don't like and the straight campaigning stuff, no, but shouldn't we always be paying attention to it?
We should. And again, another question for you, Lori. Really, Skylar Borglum is saying she's a non-politician, right, even though she's served one session in the state legislature, but by and large a person who has been in business and engineering and even a degree in theology, and so very different than Mike Rounds has served as U.S. Senator, governor for two terms, majority leader in the Senate. Are we going toward more or less politicians, experience versus inexperience, life experience?
Right. And that's what you heard a lot of people who were supporters of Donald Trump when he was a candidate was, we want this, we're tired, they were saying, they were willing to forgive some of the things that were distasteful about Donald Trump in order, or some of the things they didn't connect with, with his wealth or with, being from New York, because they saw him as a disruptor. And I think we're going to see more and more people positioning themselves as disruptors for, ineffective government as they see it. Whether or not that's how voters will see it, I guess we'll have to find out, right?
We will see as it progresses.
All right, let's talk about the initiated measure process. And Corey Heidelberger, who was a Democratic legislative candidate unsuccessfully and a pretty well-known political blogger, he was trying to refer a legislative vote to the people of South Dakota and did not collect the petition signatures. Corey was just on the program talking about that in Citizen Democracy, Direct Democracy the other day. The significance of not getting, Corey knows what he's doing as a petition gatherer. He's organized has been successful before at referring laws. What does the fact that those signatures did not come together sort of tell us, if anything?
Well, I think he is going to say that the Republicans are to blame for his not being able to get enough signatures, and I think the Republican Party, I think, did campaign against that. It does seem to back up one step, right? We aren't arguing about or debating a potential ballot issue. We're kind of doing the pre-debate where you're trying to say should it be on the ballot or not, and then in one sense is a referendum on that issue itself. So, I don't know how that is going to play out. It really appears to be very partisan, where you get people have the ability to make those laws. And again, I think in South Dakota, generally, we've been more open to that than many other states. And a lot of people would like to keep that. Other people would like to become more like other states and restrict their process. So, I think that is an issue that will continue on for a long time. And Corey's not done, right? He is circulating a petition for an initiated measure, which would undo some of the things that have been passed. So we can count on Corey being active in that realm still.
Right. And one of his points when he was here about sort of this, you know, this argument about keeping big money out of South Dakota or keeping these people who want to experiment, you know, with legislation and with the initiated measure process was, you know, you're not going to keep the billionaires from figuring this out. The only people you're keeping out are the small grassroots South Dakotans who are trying to get something, past the Republican supermajority in the state legislature. Do you think there's some truth to that, that really this is meaningless to anyone with a whole heap of money who's from out of town?
I mean, it's been really, unless I was naive for the first few decades of my life, the paid circulators and kind of the hired guns that I think in more recent years, I think most of our referendums and initiated measures were grassroots for a long time, and where you'd say, it was an era when you had stronger county party organizations, and you'd say, okay, everyone go to the county party, and they'll all circulate, they'll all volunteer to circulate, and so I think it's been recent decades when we, you know, we'll, like you say, have a billionaire finance program, you'll hire people to come to South Dakota and collect those signatures, and in that case, if that is the new reality, then it's probably a good idea to have some of these restrictions in place that would, you know, that you identify yourself as a paid circulator and you'd have a badge that, you know, when you walk up to a door and knock on it, you're not considered a dangerous person. And so whether it's the rules, my point is, I guess the rules could be different if it is going to be a grassroots thing, or if we're going to have, if this is a new reality where you have hugely financed campaigns.
And his point is that in the new reality of this legislation benefits those hugely financed campaigns and everything that he stands against, and apparently not enough petition signers, though.
Yes, that at least on this one, but I suspect this will keep going.
It's a conversation we will continue to have. John Hunter, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it. Have a wonderful and safe 4th of July.
Thanks, Lori. You as well.
Now, it's a nice weekend in South Dakota. Don't ruin it with reckless behavior. Drive safely, wear your seatbelt, don't torch yourself or your loved ones with fireworks. You know all this, right? The In the Moment News podcast is produced by Josh Heyer. Follow us on Instagram at @SDPBInTheMoment and on Twitter at @InTheMoment. Have a story idea? Send us an email, inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Josh Heyer, Chris Loffrey, and Steve Zwemke, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.